I have recently introduced this denotational semantics for call by name, call by value.
One question.
Yes?
Is it possible to postpone the deadline of the exercise? Not for this one, but in general, to Friday.
To Friday?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it was much easier to schedule the work.
Really?
Yeah,
but the thing is, I want to receive your exercises so that we discuss it right at the
right
on Wednesday. Yes, and that's what I wanted to ask you. So please send me the solutions if this is a programs before the we start the classes and give them. I mean, the written exercises also before. I mean, I don't know how to do it better.
Okay.
That was the plan that I already count on.
Okay, I assume that we are going to discuss them then the week after.
No, I mean, this, the one for which the deadline is tomorrow is going to be discussed tomorrow and the next time. So you get this... the exercise sheets every 2 weeks, and I assume that we discuss it 2 weeks, for 2 weeks. So, like, we discuss the first part 1 week, and then the second part next week. All right?
And the points of the exercises will be for the note at the end.
Yes, that's half of the note.
Yeah.
I mean, so the exercises are going to be available 2 weeks ahead. So plan ahead and start earlier. Right. So I would ask you to send the programs as emails so that you could run them. Okay. And the written exercises with proof, etc., just as normal written exercises. Okay, any questions about it? Right, so the denotational semantic that I've presented recently, so basically from the formal point of view, this is all you need. But of course, it's going to be difficult to do it without an example. So I prepared an example for today. And I tried to do it before these classes. And it turned out that that's quite involved. So there are lots of bureaucracy. If you do it in every single detail, then it occupies lots of time. So maybe I try to shorten it somehow. But I cannot skip it also because without a concrete example, you probably wouldn't get the feeling how it works. And we want to get this feeling and carry it further because I want to use this example, so this denotational semantics business as a motivation for the further things. So, and I also typed in these rules and for your convenience, put it on the web page. You can look it up. I've added a PDF file where you can read it offline. You can do it right away if you want. So, and the example that I'm going to do is basically I mentioned the soundness and adequacy theorems showing that operational semantics and denotational semantics agree in a certain sense. It's difficult to show, so I just show it by example. I do this example of a factorial function and show that both semantics calculate the factorial correctly. And as I said, for the case of denotational semantics, I cannot really do it completely. So I show you some important pieces, I hope, and try to convince you that the rest would follow. So let's just consider this this factorial example again. So if you write it completely as a term in context, it looks like this. So this is my context, which consists of one variable only. I made this term a bit more complex than it could be for illustrating purposes. So this is my term. It depends on one variable. This is x. And this is the fixed point combinator. Mind you, I sometimes omit this this index here. But actually, if you stay completely formal, then you need to write this index all the time. So this is the type of the values I iterate over. And strictly saying, we are having not one combinator y, but we have a family of combinators y for every such type. So for different indexes, this is a different combinators. And this is the body, which I explained before. Right. And then I start from the easy side. So I show that like my claim is that okay, let's give us names to this animals. So let me call this P. And let me call this Q. So my claim is that lambda xp, if I apply it to n, then this converges to n factorial n call by value. So I ignore the indexes at the arrows and just indicate that we stay in call by value all the time. So how I prove it? I prove it by induction. So my induction step is n equals 0, so I have to prove that the result will be 1. Okay, there are going to be a lengthy calculation. So I try to form lambda xp 0. So I will try to derive this judgment, because this is exactly what my induction step says. I must converge to factorial 0, and factorial 0 is 1. So I have to prove this. How I prove it? Well, I'm just using the rules. This is a true judgment, because lambda xp is a value, so it converges to a value. 0 converges to 0. And then I have to show that yq 0 converges to 1. So these things are axioms. I can write it like this. There is nothing on top. If you look at the semantics, they are axioms. But this is not an axiom, so I have to prove it. Right, and in order to prove it, okay, this is an application again, so I need to evaluate the individual components. So Q evaluates to Q, because by definition Q is a lambda abstraction, so it doesn't reduce to anything. And again, zero is zero. So then, I'm confused. So, right, this is an application, so I need to calculate. Q. So let's pretend that I still do not know what this is. Then I need to evaluate zero. And then there is a leftover, so which I will know once I know what this evaluates to. Okay, so to calculate this, I use the rule for my fixed point operator, so I need to calculate the argument. The argument is a lambda abstraction, so here we get an axiom. And then in call by value, we calculate Q lambda x y q x. This expression. So this is one of the rules for the fixed points. So this is an application again, and I need to calculate it. I need to evaluate Q. Q evaluates to Q again. Then I need to evaluate the argument. So the argument evaluates to itself. And then I'm left with the composition. So I need to, according to the rules, I need to take Q and substitute this function instead of the argument of Q, which is F. So I just take that term and replace F. I mean, I remove the lambda abstraction and replace the F by the body of my function. So this will all not fit here. So basically, I take lambda x if x smaller than 1, then 1. else x times. So here I replace this by lambda x. Yx, and I apply this all to x. Right, this is what happens. Yes? Yes, right. Thank you. All right, and now this evaluates to itself again. So let me just call it G, and then G evaluates to G because it's a lambda abstraction. So again, this is how we calculate this the result here. Hence we get G here, and hence we get G here. Okay, and now I'm back to this place where I know that this yg converges to g and 0 converges to 0. And now I just apply g to 0. So now I know these values. And basically what happens here, I mean the same story again, g evaluates to g 0 to 0, and g 0 evaluates to what? Eventually it evaluates to 1. So there are more things here because it's again not an axiom. Wait. So here I need to do replacement. So G, where I replace x with 0, evaluates to 1. So I just take this G and replace x with 1 here. And then there are probably one more rule saying that this will converge to 1, because if you replace x by 1 here, then this if will work out and would output 1. So in the end, we get 1. So there's one more rule for if here, but I just do not have room anymore. And here we'll get 1, and here I get 1. So this is the proof. This is what you get if you do it formally. Well, almost formally, except for this small bit which I ignored. And now I've got, this was induction base. And induction step. So I just do not repeat it. The induction step is quite analogous, so you do everything the same. So you need to prove that lambda xp 0 n plus 1 evaluates to n plus 1 factorial. Right. So, and you've got pretty much the same calculation above, except that at basically at this position, instead of 0, you would have 1. Maybe I just highlight this place where it differs. I mean, of course, the difference is you will have n plus 1 instead of 0 everywhere, but the crucial place is where it plays a role is there. So you get g, where g is the same, n plus 1 x. And I want to show that this is n plus 1 factorial. And then again, the same argument applies, but instead of the left branch of the if, I use the right-hand branch because n plus 1 is greater than 1. So what I have here is n plus 1 greater than 1 evaluates to true, and which is just axiom. And what lambda x q I also missed the x here, right? Or not? X times. So I've got n plus 1 times lambda x, y, q, x, and I applied to n, right? Because n is n plus 1 minus 1. So of course I expect that this will be n plus 1 factorial. So n plus 1 evaluates to n plus 1 again, and this evaluates to n factorial. Right, so since I want to compute the multiplication, so I evaluate the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And to evaluate the right-hand side, I basically need to know that okay, the same thing again, lambda x, y x, x, evaluates to itself, lambda x, y x. And n evaluates to m, and I need to know that this evaluates to n plus 1, n factorial, right, according to the rule for the application. Actually, I could finish earlier. So, because this thing is lambda x p applied to M, right? So hence this we have by induction hypothesis. Right, so this is the complete proof. We built an infinite tree, but it's not infinite, it's finite, but to build the rest of this tree we just call the induction hypothesis in this place, because we know that the proof of this thing exists. We just can attach that tree which we built in previous iterations here. Okay, so this was the easy part. This was the operational semantics, and this is a lengthy calculation, but this is just trees. You have a bunch of rules, and you transform from the axioms to the goal, much in the same way you do it in the logics. So when you prove that some statement is provable from the axioms. So the hardest part is to show the same using the denotational semantics. And I will need certain preliminaries for this. So you could notice that when we do we calculate the operational semantics, then we can ignore all this fuss about this term context. But we cannot do this if we do denotational semantics. I mean, that's why in some books they don't care about the computation context, and you know this from the courses in logics, that there is no such a formal treatment of variables. So there is no such bureaucratic calculus for doing things about free variables. You just declare free variables as sets, and you use them easily. So if you want to be formal and you're interested in denotational semantics, you have to care about them. And if you have simple language, then it looks like there are lots of bureaucracy, there are lots of unnecessary things, but this pays off when you switch to something complex. Right, so I need to say, I will have to say how I obtained this term. So this is something that I conjecture, but in principle, I need to provide a proof that this term is correct, because I gave you a bunch of rules saying that a term in context is something that I can derive from these rules. And this works much the same way. I did it in the operational semantics. So I need to prove this term. So I need to get this in the very bottom of my proof system, well, of my proof. I will omit this this index at y from now on, because it will not matter anymore. If x smaller than 1, then 1 else x times f x minus 1 of x. So now if I look at my term construction rules, what I have to do here is I need to derive this, not if, no, lambda f, lambda x, dot, dot, dot. Okay, I didn't mention that the result of this is what? Let's be completely formal. So this is n to, no, this is just n. So my fixed point calculates a function. I apply this function to a natural and I get a natural. So I need to get this and I need to get that x not x n, and here I've got n to n. So these are my two premises, and this is again an axiom. So this was one of those first axioms where I say that if a variable belongs to the context, then this is a valid term. I don't need any premises for this. And to show this thing, I need a rule for the fixed point. So this rule is like this, not so this is the type of the expression under y. Okay, how we get this? There is a rule for lambda. F goes from n naught to naught. And I have to derive lambda x. Okay, let's write this term completely. If x smaller than 1, then 1 else x times f x minus 1. Right? So now you see that my context become more inhabited. So in the end, I have only x in the context, and before I at this point, I have the f in the context, because since I bind it in the next step, it will be removed according to the rule. But before, it appears there. And now, moreover, okay, so here I need to rename this variable because otherwise I cannot make a step. So I'm using the alpha conversion here because I wouldn't be able to add this x to the context. So not f not to not, and then y of type not, and then if, okay, this is also renamed, y smaller than 1, then 1 else minus 1, right? And this is more or less it. Well, almost. Now I need to derive this term. This term is derived from three premises. This is a term, this is a term, and this is a term. So I will just stop here at this place. So the contexts are the same. Y smaller than 1. Okay, I keep forgetting the types. Okay, right. So this type was like this, this type is like this, n to n, and this type is just n. So this is bool, and then this is not, and then not, so, right, so this is not an axiom. There are one more rule here because this is not an elementary expression. This is an axiom, and this is again not an axiom because we construct this composition out of two branches, and then y minus 1 is again a complex term. It's built from 1 and y, but I mean these rules are straightforward now. So I think this is the interesting bit, and can just finish it yourself. That's how this derivation works. Maybe I should have shown it when I introduced the context. Clear? By the way, so when I give the semantics, so when I give the denotational semantics, I say that if I have a context and a term and a type, so then the semantics of it is a one bottom times a n bottom to, no, there are no bottoms here. And the result is this. So I'm giving the semantics. The type of the result is like this, where gamma is x1, a1. So gamma is this list. Is there anything suspicious here? maybe, I mean, there are some corner cases where it may work only conditionally. So the corner case is when we get empty context, right? So if the context is empty, then we need to find a Cartesian product of empty number of components. What is that? So the product of empty numbers components, and accidentally it's that terminal type 1. So it's we can write it like P. I belongs to the empty set of AE. So apparently if the context is empty, if you want to calculate something like this, then the type of this is from 1 to A. So, and it's sometimes annoying that you need to consider the result as a function from 1. You wanted to ask something?
Question. Shouldn't there be a button attached to the A? Because
this, yeah, right. So, because by definition, I think I defined it like this. Ah, okay. There are underscores here. That I forgot. So if you look at this sheet that I put on the at the web page, then it's consistent with that. And I think it's consistent with what I said in the lecture. So because for call by value, you need to define the semantics in two steps. So first you define the semantics for values, which is my underscores, and then you define the semantics for computations. And the semantic for computation is basically just a semantics of a value plus divergence, because computation can diverge, but values cannot diverge. That's the difference. Right, so we get the semantics for the empty context, and apparently in my calculations I use sometimes this sort of notation, row of type 1. I mean, I use generally this row, but in this particular case, it's a row of type 1, and this is a type which has only one element. So this row is not very useful here. That's why it's often dropped. I mean, this is something that that you possibly do not notice at all when you do when you're in sets. So if you do set theory, then there is no difference between elements of a set and functions from one point set to this set, because every such function chooses an element. So it doesn't make a difference between these two things, and you just identify them. So you can identify them here as well, but you need to be a bit careful, because all these rules, I mean, have to be tweaked a bit. So, because they do not know about this convention. So if you use this convention, then you, in the rules, you need to remember about it. Right. So the idea that I have next is basically show you some fragments of that the same example with factorial. No, that's probably, let it stay here. Maybe I would still need it. So what I wanted to show is that lambda x p n, so this is equal to n factorial. That would be my goal, but as I said, I tried that, this is hard. So instead, I just show that, well, what I will try to show is that this lambda x p n, so that this is equal to y q n. To begin, because this expression is a necessary complex, because you've got a lambda abstraction and you apply it to an n, so this converges by beta reduction. So, and if I just start in calculating, that's going to be a lengthy expression. Instead, I just simplify it. So I say that I prove that the semantics of this is equal to the semantics of this. And if I stick to this, then it's easier to show that it would be easier to show that it's equal to my target. Right, but how do I prove it? Well, you've seen the rules for the denotational semantics. By the way, I forgot to mention or to draw your attention to the fact that these rules are compositional in the sense. I explained in the very beginning. So the semantics, the denotational semantic is compositional. If you define a semantics of complex things in terms of the simplest things. And this is clearly visible for called by name, because there you basically just interpret things trivially. So you say that lambda abstraction is a lambda abstraction, application is application, and etc. So you compare left-hand side and right-hand side, and then you basically just distribute this brackets throughout the terms. And for called by values, the semantics is again compositional, but just the dependency between the semantics of a complex thing and its part is not so straightforward. So then you need to involve this let expression, but still it's compositional, although this dependency is not as straightforward as for called by name. So it need not be straightforward, just has to exist. So right, if I want to show this, I would use my these rules which I gave and calculate the right left-hand side, calculate the right-hand side, and see that they are identical. And indeed, you can do it. But I would need two laws which are important for the next, and which are, to a large extent, provide me with the motivation to do it, of doing this all. So these are the laws for let. So that magic let constructor which we have introduced, we can show that it has certain properties. So let x gets t in p, this is equal to p in which I substitute t instead of x. And this is, I can call that unit. Why it's unit, it will be clear, hopefully, in the later lectures. But I hope that you can understand why it's true. So this operation, it lifts a value to a computation which never diverges. So this computation always outputs t. It never diverges because of these brackets. And the let constructor says, evaluate this program and then take the result and dispatch it to the rest. Now, since we know that it never diverges, the result of this program is t itself. Hence, we just substitute x in the rest by t. That's the meaning of this. And you can prove it formally. It's not difficult at all, because we know how this let is defined. So the let and the brackets, they are defined in such a way that I've got lambda x p. So I use the star and I apply it to t. Now I can use the definition for the star. You remember that I've considered two clauses. So this is equal to p of s if t is equal to s and bottom otherwise. But of course, in this case, this holds. Lambda x p of s. So hence I just, t and s are identical, hence I replace them here, lambda x p, t, and in the end I've got p t x. Right, because this is a lambda abstraction applied. And note that this right-hand side, here I calculate the terms on the semantic level. So these are terms in the set theoretic sense. So I just use the fact that I can reason about lambda terms on the set level, and beta reduction, of course, works for the function on set level. So this is one rule for let, and the other rule is let asoc. It's associativity of let. Let x gets p in let y gets q in r equal to let y gets let x gets p in q in r. And there is a side condition saying that right, there's a side condition saying that x is not free in R. I mean free in the sense that R, I mean, I shortened the context and things, but this has nothing to do with the context, because here we on the semantic level yet, so this is they are free and bound in the sense that if we construct this p, q, and r as terms and set theoretic functions that they do not depend on certain variables. So, right, I say that X is not free in R because otherwise it would be strange, because this errors, they work as binders. When I say I bind the result of P to X, it means that X is then used in the rest, and in particular, it could be used in R. But on the right-hand side, the scope of this X variable, it finishes here. So if R depended on X, then we would have a dangling variable in R. So this R would depend here, and it would be the free variable of all term. And here it would be bound, so X wouldn't be a free variable of the left-hand side. So, and this is something that you could prove just as well using this simple reasoning. I'm not going to do it. Maybe I'd give it as an exercise. So you can prove it by definition. And yeah, so I don't know if you more or less understand it. The point is you like run these programs, so you run this program, and then you run this program, and then you run this program. And this is the same as, well, the same, but you run first P, then Q, and then this construction forms a group, which you can consider as a program itself, and you evaluate the result to Y, and then use this Y in R. So it's just grouping, like, putting the brackets in a different way, and this is why it's called associativity. So these two laws are very helpful for reasoning about expression involving lead. Specifically, we can calculate the left-hand side, or maybe the right-hand side is more or less simple because so the right-hand side is this. So it's let G gets Y Q in brackets. And G of M. So if you just calculate this, I mean, there's one more iteration here. Well, actually, maybe it's worth it to show this iteration because I'm going to use one of these rules. So I could say in let X gets N in G of X. So this is what I obtain if I just use the rules directly. And now here you can see that I can use my unit law. So this simplifies then. Let G gets Y Q in Gn. So this is my right hand side. And let's try to calculate the left-hand side. Left-hand side, lambda x p n. Let f gets Cauchy. Let or gets this g. And let y gets x. G Y. In let him Well, okay, I just simplify it right away because I know that this is, it's this. So now I can use the unit law to simplify this part. I mean, I can use the unit law twice because here I've got something in these brackets. So I can use the unit law to substitute it here, but first I can apply the unit law here again, and also simplify it to f of n. So I get f of n, but f is substituted itself, but the corresponding expression. So in the end, I've got Cauchy let G gets Q in let of n. Yes. Okay, and now at this point, I basically just using the definition of Cauchy. Cauchy says that you get a function working on pairs, and it produces a function which takes first argument, returns a function, and then consumes the second argument and produces a function. But the point is here that this first argument of Cauchy is that empty context. So it consumes the terminal object, and according to this convention, informal we ignore those arguments of terminal types. So in fact, you can simplify it to let g gets y q in. So you would have to replace this uh, uh, the x in this term by n, because this is the effect of carry. It the function inside it depends on that dummy variable of terminal type and on x. But if we carry it and apply to n, then we get this x substituted by n. So let y m in g y. And by the unique law, we get let g gets y q in g of n. Right, so we get these are these sort of brackets here. So this is the same expression again. I didn't use this associativity law, just trust me that it's useful too. So I cannot finish this calculation because, again, as I said, if you do it in every single detail, that gets difficult, uncomprehensive. So I just tell you the strategy. So that was the part of the strategy. I proved that this is equal to that, and this is a more tractable expression. I can. Show that this is simply equal to what? To let f gets q in mu f star in fn and this is furthermore equal to let f gets. Ah, okay, here I can use the associativity law because I've got two lets. So, right, I can put this let forward. Q in let f gets mu f star in fn. So this is more suggestive, right? So when you just write down the term using the denotational semantics, you get this, but the meaning of it is more clear if you write it using the associativity law, because it's instructive. It says that first execute Q, then calculate the fixed point, and then apply this fixed point to N. I mean, I could use a different variable here, of course, or here, h of n. I mean, what I wrote before was correct. I just using this f bind the result to it, and then using f, so this f shadows the original f which I used here. So it was fine, but. For comprehension, one can use different variables. And this is equal to let f gets lambda f lambda x q const x less than y, 1 x times f x minus 1 in mu f star in f m. In let h gets mu f star in h n. So this is what you get if you calculate this semantics here. And this can be simplified further because this is, again, you can apply the unit law and you can reduce to one let. So if you do it to the end, eventually what you get is really that factorial function. Of course, there is this also the fixed point, but you know how to calculate the fixed point. They are great. Least upper bounds. So we would need to unfold that the semantics of q and times, and you would get a chain. And basically, if you calculate the least upper bound of the chain, which is calculated pointwise, so then you can reduce this expression to the end. So, but you see. How long it takes if you do it all in detail. So, questions to this? And what we are going to take from this example is the loss for let and the syntax for let. Right. So coming back to the practical programming perspective and to doing Haskell, one can observe several things. So that primer that I've shown you on the previous lecture, basically I've outlined the formal background or the features, the things which are available, and there are not so many of them. So there's lambda calculus, polymorphism, and algebraic data types. We did the lambda calculus in a certain extent, quite a lot. And I've explained the polymorphism a bit. I didn't explain algebraic data types. So I'm going to do it on one of the next lectures. But this is, algebraic data types basically is not a big deal. You've seen lists, and algebraic data types are not too far from lists. So instead of lists, which are there's a particular sort of trees, they are linear trees. And if you switch from lists to general trees, then basically this is what you get as algebraic data types. So there are just many syntactic sugar added to it, but from a formal point of view, they are just trees, more or less. So you would have lists and you would have trees, and this is the full stock of features that Haskell provides you. But then, from the practical perspective, you can ask certain questions. If you want to program there, you can pose certain problems, because this collection of features seemingly not sufficient for convenient programming. Although it, theoretically it is sufficient, because as I said, even very simple simple language like PCF is Turing complete, so theoretically you can program everything, but in practice you need more. So I'm not going to come up with like a full list of complaints, I just show you some. So one question which you may consider to be missing, I mean, if you just look at this collection of features for the first time, is like interaction. In a broad sense. Because in lambda calculus, well, they are just mathematical expressions. You don't care how you input information, how you output information, how you connect to the ports, how you send send information between programs. And this is all what you care about when you do a real programming. Plus, there are certain things which are just not programmable, like a random number generator. So if you're in any language like ML or C, you just need to call something external, like generate a random number for you. The program, this PCF, for example, is not capable of generating random numbers because everything is deterministic there. You need some oracle from outside who would tell you what this is your random number. Interaction interfaces. So you need to some notion of interface to the outer world. And this can be like input, output, random, etc. Then another thing is like states. And imperative style of programming. So I probably mentioned that PCF, for example, you've got this generic recursion operator, and it's good for everything. Like you can program the while loop using the while. But how you do it, that's what matters for real programming. So, for example, in some languages, let me give you an example, which is in a pseudocode, while r equal to 1 and I equal to 1, then while I is smaller than m, so we update r and increment the counter. Well, let's say it's bracketed like this, and then return r. So this is an imperative version of my factorial function. I just initialized the counter, and this is the variable to collect the results, and then I do it in a cycle, and in the end I'm supposed to return this result. But the question is, what is this? What is this, and what is this, and what is this? So there is this assignment and there is a return, and it's not at all trivial to even to come up with an idea of what this should what is supposed to mean in lambda calculus. Well, actually, maybe just sketch a possible solution here. So apparently, we could extend our term language with something like gamma p of a and gamma x of a bool. And then we can have gamma xa qa. And I could derive gamma init x equal to p while b Q. So this is like a new term formation rule which I could add into my language. So what I'm doing here is, this is my initialization constraint, so I can use it for this clause. And then this is my while loop, this is a condition, and this is the body of the loop. And so it's not a new thing. So it's like a syntactic sugar, which I basically can derive in PCF. So like if I have init x is equal to p while, so don't write it down because I think I would need to fix the mistake here. Right, and I need to apply it to P. Hopefully it's correct. So if you have the fixed point combinator, then you also have a while loop like this. But is it a good while loop? I mean, it's as good as we can have. If you want to formalize my example here, what I would do, I would write something like init let's say y equal to 1, 1 while PR. So this refers to E, this refers to R. So I need to take the first projection of y. If it's smaller than m, then what? Then there is something like I need to return PR 1, y plus 1, and PR 2, 1 times PR 1, y. Right. And then I will have to project all this on PR2. So it's considerably less elegant than in imperative languages. And this is a very simple example. So we care here about the error. R is our result. Well, actually, R is our result, and I is the index. But there can be lots of background information which we need in real programs. So we can call other functions and other variables. And if we use the style, we need to compose a big piece of data and carry it explicitly via a variable of this type. So we will need to decide what this thing is. Okay, so the short point, I just add the short point here and finish. The short point is control. Exceptions, backtracking, and other features. So there are many things which make programming more convenient and concise, like exceptions. So you can write an exception and finish the program very quickly. This is something that you can do natively in the Lambda term. You need you can encode the exception somehow there, but and this is what will happen, but it's not straightforward how to do it. Because by default there are no native things like exceptions there. Backtracking, there are other control features which allow you to manipulate the control flow. Like you want to escape from certain place quickly, or you want to escape until some previously chosen point, etc. This is all what you don't have by default in language like PCF. So, and this is seemingly things which you don't have in Haskell. But as we will see, this magic let constructor basically a key for treating all these points, and you do have all these features in Haskell. You just use the specific features of it to model them, and this is closely related to the material I've explained before, and to this let operator. So all right, this is it. Thank you. As I said, I'm expecting the exercises before the start of the next classes tomorrow.